High tech and the digital divide. That's the subject of talks this week by a visiting professor. Richard Tedlow is a business historian, an endowed professor at Harvard Law School. And for the last several years, he's been at Apple University. He just retired from that post last month. Now, he spoke at the UH Law School and at the Schuyler School of Business about what lies ahead.
Certainly, in Silicon Valley, the term you hear most often is artificial intelligence. So a lot of companies are spending a lot of money and making a lot of big bets that artificial intelligence is the future. Exactly what that means depends on whom you speak with. It's difficult to do. There is a lot of talk about self-driving cars. Once again, there's a gap between promise and performance. The promise is wonderful. Whether we're actually going to get, real level 5 autonomy, in other words, cars that you just walk into, tell it where to go, and you don't have a steering wheel, whether we're going to get that before the next ice age, and we're having global warming now, that remains to be seen.
But it's the whole George Jetson thing, and when you start thinking about, gosh, we could have, flying cars.
Well, if some of these changes can be made, it would be great for society. It would be great for the elderly, like me. I'm 71. It would be great for people with disabilities. It would be enormously liberating. And that's the real promise of big tech, is liberation. Thanks to app development, for example, on the phone, you can be homebound for any number of reasons and be an entrepreneur. That's new in this world, and to me, it's a tremendous step forward and a wonderful contribution to society.
It's scary, but it's also exciting. I mean, I think of Downton Abbey and Carson the butler staring at the toaster.
Yes,
you had such social upheaval at that time, women got the right to vote. You had cars. I mean, just a remarkable time. And there's a parallel here, it seems like. I mean, there's just so much incredible good that could come of this, and then there's also the bad.
Yes. The social changes that were, if I may cite Downton Abbey again, since you brought it up, there's a wonderful line in there where Maggie Smith, who's sort of the Dowager Duchess, my recollection is, her grand, the man who winds up marrying Lady Mary, whose name now slips my mind, forgive me.
Matthew,
thank you very much. Talks about something happening on a weekend, and she says, "What is a weekend?" And, but personally, I don't live that life, and haven't lived that life. But that's the life that when you were an upper-class aristocrat in Britain in the 19th century, it didn't matter.
Right. What's a weekend?
Yeah, somebody was taking care of everything. We're in the midst of transitions that are as dramatic as that. You can communicate with anybody, anywhere now. I think the question is, what do you have to say? The definition of broadcasting has changed tremendously. So, for example, you can tweet to if you're a public figure to 50 million people or more, and yet if you're not someone who pays any attention to that, you're completely out of that. So, in a sense, high tech has greatly expanded the reach. But in a sense, it's also narrowed it. It's expanded it. But the river's longer, but it's narrower. If you don't happen to follow somebody, then you don't know what's going on. And there were certain advantages to the era of the 1960s and the 1970s, where we had true broadcasting, where everybody watched ABC, CBS, NBC, and then finally CNN. Because there was a certain sense that everybody was getting the same information.
Right, and before that it was radio, where we all listened to the radio.
That's correct.
Before there was TV.
That's correct. It took a long time for people to understand what radio was. I mean, they understood it from a mechanical and from an engineering standpoint, but You know, one idea was that it was going to be a telephone booth of the air, that you were going to walk into a telephone booth, literally put in a coin or two, and then just talk to people who are going to follow you, which is a little like social media today. Social media does allow you to express yourself to a large number of people, but it also allows something called cyberbullying, which when I was growing up didn't exist, and is real, and is awful.
But you've just retired from Apple University, and you're not on social media.
I am not.
Explain yourself.
I'm an historian, and one of the things you learn when you study history is that you march backward into the future. And to a certain extent, that's what I'm doing. I like my privacy, number one. And number two, I just find it hard to believe that the friends that I have would be really interested in the fish that I had last night. It doesn't appeal to me.
Do you use an iPhone?
Oh, yes, very much so. Among the things that I find appealing about the iPhone, and this is something interesting about Apple as a company, is I like the aesthetics of it. I think it's beautiful. For a lot of people, an iPhone is today a camera with a phone attached, and a lot of them use it for gaming. A lot of them use it for texting. I actually use it for talking. And when the iPhone was introduced, which was in 2007, if you looked at Steve Jobs' keynote introducing it, the camera was a 2-megapixel rear-facing camera, and it was not part of the value proposition at all. In other words, Apple as a company learned from its users what that phone was going to become, and that's intriguing. Take a look at one of the beautiful sunsets that you have in Hawaii. Everybody's out there with their cameras, and those cameras are all attached to phones. Not all of them, but many of them. Because the truth is that the cameras on the iPhones are really superb.
They really are.
And the number of photographs that are uploaded to the cloud, I have no idea, frankly, what the number is, but if it were in the billions daily, it wouldn't surprise me. There are well over a billion phones in active use right now. The cameras, one of the major apps that goes on that phone. I don't think it's possible, in fact, to market a smartphone successfully that doesn't have a great camera.
The way I look at technology is I want to use it more than it uses me. Like you said, you don't have privacy, but they know what you shop for and what you might shop for and those kinds of things. So that's always a little kind of scary.
You have to make a choice about what you're going to do, what you're going to use. I'm in control of my social media presence. I'm not on it.
There you go.
And I don't feel impoverished as a result of that. If people want to get in touch with me, if they have to make a little extra effort, that's fine. I don't like the thought of being tracked, and I don't like the thought of visiting upon other people details of my life that are profoundly trivial.
And as far as the talks that you'll be giving, is there one message that you want to underscore?
I think personally that America is at its best as a nation when it's inclusive. So I think a good test with regard to technology is how inclusive does it make the country? And matter of fact, how inclusive does it make the country in the world? How inclusive does it make an individual citizen? Or are we all just atoms in the universe interacting now and again? I think that's an important test.
That was business historian Richard Tedlow in town this week for lectures at UH. An expert on management, marketing, and strategy, he's the author of Giants of Enterprise, Andy Grove, and Denial, Why Business Leaders Fail to Look Facts in the Face. He's also writing a book on the subject of technology and inclusiveness and the digital divide.